When we go on a journey these days, we take our own music with us, don't we? Which is not a terribly new idea, actually. I mean, before the technology, before they had sort of headphones and iPods and Spotify and iTunes, I mean, they may not take their own music with them in the same way, but in those days, they made their own music. And these three psalms, these three songs, whether they were written for an actual journey or not, they tell the story of pilgrimage, of the kind of journey any disciple will find themselves on. If they'd had hymn books in those days, and not just collective memory, well, these songs would have found their way into the Pilgrim's Praise collection of the day. And this series will look at three of them that tell a story. It's a story of traveling, and it begins in a world I don't belong in anymore. I don't feel I fit anymore. And it goes through the experience of the protection of the keeper God and ends with the joy of making it home. But it all starts with a growing homesickness. We're finding ourselves out of sorts with our surroundings, with it all being too much to bear. And the pilgrims in this psalm, they start out, to be frank, in a bad way and in a bad place. And they know it. And whether you're a believer or not, if you and I are going to taste the journey, we need to taste that distress. So, begin our looking. So, I'm going to look at verse 1. I call on the Lord in my distress, the psalm starts, and he answers me. Actually, they're better translated as past tenses. I called on the Lord, and he answered me. As if for all that this will be true for any disciple, it has its roots in a particular experience. Some think of Nehemiah. You may remember he rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem and built up the people of God, but he did it in the face of constant sniping, barbed criticisms, twisted lies, manipulation of the media. But whoever's experience it started with, it's not far from any disciple's experience. See, what did they cry? Well, look at verse 2. Save me, Lord, from lying lips and deceitful tongues. And you imagine buried somewhere in the Hebrew is the idea of heartless tweets as well. Lying lips and deceitful tongues. I mean, at first we're relieved, aren't we? Because we were expecting something far worse. And people, Christian people, face far worse every day around the world. And then we realize the Lord doesn't need headline sins to respond. He knows our thoughts. He hears all our careless, twisted words. Remember that playground saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names can never harm me? But they can. And very deeply. Look, there'll be plenty of us here tonight who will have had throwaway comments we've nursed in our mind for years. And they still come back to haunt us and sting us. I've listened to a 10-minute diatribe in a public meeting, twisting my motives, trashing my integrity. I can tell you it hurts. And brothers and sisters around the world will tell you of real persecution. That lying lips and Pakistan's blasphemy laws can very easily land you in prison, if not in execution. You begin to understand why some universities get so precious about creating a safe space for students so that they don't feel offended, experience this kind of hurt. The thing is, the length some go to challenges the ideas of education and free speech and free debate. You know, when they have to give trigger warnings for upsetting content in plays like Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus or reshape history lectures, when speakers get no platformed. Speakers like Germaine Greer, no platform for her views on transgenderism, or Peter Tatchell even, no platform for his response to that and his ideas of free speech. Now, don't expect a safe place if you're a Christian. The psalmist didn't get one, nor will we. I mean, to be honest, real life doesn't offer safe spaces from lying lips and deceitful tongues, whoever you are. when we last met a couple of weeks back for our last prayer gathering, we saw a striking, moving little video of a Nigerian girl who was trafficked into the sex trade here on the promise of a job as a waitress. Turned out to be a job in prostitution. It was several months before our team met her. Many more months before she called on the Lord, and he answered her and saved her from lying lips. Lying lips, deceitful tongues. See, you don't have to tell lies to manipulate the truth. And our culture has found many ways to establish its points without ever facing the arguments or even indicating there are any. I mean, oversimplifying or normalizing can be very effective. We do it in the church. Agree to disagree has become a catchphrase that's now a remedy for far too many divisions. When it's the answer to everything, unity replaces truth. So you have to ask, when we've all agreed to disagree about everything and we're all reconciled together, are we still reconciled with God? Or do his views not matter anymore? It happens in politics. Janice Turner is a columnist on the Times. As far as I'm aware, she has no Christian faith. Yesterday, she wrote an article about how the speed with which transgenderism is being accommodated with children goes against all clinical advice. And she quotes Theresa May as saying, "Being trans is not an illness and should not be treated as such." So why, writes Turner, does it require surgery, drugs, and lifelong patienthood? Or again, the culture uses a story to normalize an issue. A storyline in a TV soap is a very powerful way to argue a case without having to argue it. Or a primary school reading book where gender, marriage, family are all set up in a way that presumes the child reading it will move seamlessly to see this as normal, expected, morally right, as if there are no issues at all. And there are several primary school books like that. And then there's the media itself. I mean, this week you can see it just around the corner on the piazza. The BBC unveiled a statue of George Orwell with a quote beside it. This is the Orwell quote. "If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear." Now, countries without a broadcaster independent of the government will know the value of this. Speaking what the government may not want you to hear. But it's the truth. But it bites both ways. Even the BBC has its own built-in deafness. Things it does not want to hear. That quote will be quite a challenge for them as well as from them. Deceitful tongues. You see, the psalmist has lived with manipulation of the truth for too long. "Save me, Lord," he cries. Feel the distress, then grasp the hope. See, "I call on the Lord." Now look at verse 3. "What will he do to you? What more besides, you deceitful tongue?" Do you hear the psalmist's brain whirring, wrestling with the question, surely God's not going to just turn a blind eye to all of this. And then he's worked it out. Verse 4. "He will punish you with a warrior's sharp arrows, with burning coals of the broom brush." It's vivid language. For all the damage caused by the lying lips and their slanderous barbs and their cutting comments, the enemy is outgunned by this warrior's arrows and the fire that pictures the Lord's hostility to sin. It's vivid, but it's more fact than venom. What will he do? He will punish. I mean, that is the promise. The promise we ignore at our peril that God will judge sin. That is the promise that brings hope, because injustice rankles, doesn't it? I was listening to a Radio 5 Live program the other day in the car, and they were asking listeners to call in with comments about injustices that rankled with them. as you listen to the comments as they flowed in, most of them appeared, at any rate, very superficial, but they kind of went back to school sports days. And you thought, if it had been a real deep injustice, well, that's the promise. The promise we cling to when we're on the receiving end of those lying lips, they will not have the last word. And it's a promise with substance. Remember how Paul speaks? He speaks of how God has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he's appointed, and he's given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. That justice is as sure and certain as that Jesus came out of that tomb on Easter Sunday. The psalmist isn't the last person to wrestle with how the Lord will respond to the hurts and injustices of life. What will he do? And not the last person to grasp this hope. He will punish. One day he will sort it out. And my colleague Rico Tice was telling me of a friend of his who'd been wrestling with the truths of the Christian faith and the claims of Christ. The rest of the family hadn't engaged at all. And when he came to his decision and made his mind up, he said to Rico, "It had better be true, Rico. As far as the family are concerned, I'm betting the farm on it. I'm staking everything on it." Well, the psalmist, as he goes through the mill, the disciple, as she suffers the hurts, is betting the farm on it. What will he do? He will punish. Now, I know we live in a liberal-minded culture that rejects the idea of God's judgment and runs from the thought of it. But friends, keep your eyes open. You'll find that same liberal elite contradicts itself without even noticing. See, the Hollywood liberal elite is rocked by sex scandals at the moment, isn't it? And rightly horrified by them. And at a stroke, Kevin Spacey is wiped from a movie that's already been filmed. Due to be released in 6 weeks, they'll reshoot it without him in it. Harvey Weinstein, the producer, he's gone, but the demand is that he should not be seen as sick and in need of rehab, but as a predator and in need of prison. What will Hollywood do? They will punish. What will God do? Why do we expect him to be less just? When lying lips have destroyed lives and exploited people and savaged men and women, he will punish. You can bet the farm on it. So the rest of the psalm is a surprise, you see. Feel the distress, grasp the hope, but then it's as if he goes back. Taste the despair, the psalmist goes on. It's as if he can't let go. He's clinging so tightly to the hope because the hurt is so deep, and however sure the ending, we still have to live the present. And the psalmist won't let me short-circuit the experience, skip the distress, and just enjoy the hope. And the psalm is here in God's book, so that we sing this song to one another, we reread this truth to ourselves, in part to set our expectations for the Christian life, so that we're not naive and shocked by the evil we find and imagine it's all gone wrong and it's all turned sour. See how he goes on at the end? That final paragraph, verse 5. "Woe to me that I dwell in Meshech, that I live among the tents of Kedar." Actually, it would have been impossible to live in both Meshech and Kedar at the same time. They're hundreds of miles apart. They're obviously symbolic. Kedar carries, the word carries the sense of dark and in the darkness. And here were places, societies at odds with the people of God, and the psalmist lived in one of them. In the darkness, like some resident alien, always on edge with the culture around him. Now, Christians around the world who've lost education, family, jobs, freedom for their faith, and the statistics show that Christians are the most persecuted group across the globe. She or he would be singing these words with real feeling. woe is me. Oh, it's a deep sigh of weariness. It's not the tut-tutting, you know, the sort of superficial disciple climbing on some moral soapbox and getting ready to jab fingers at people. Too long have I lived among those who hate peace. Too long I've had enough. I can't take any more. I mean, can you imagine what it would be like if we faced real persecution in this country? Wouldn't the butterflies be in the stomach day after day? You're wondering where the next hit is coming from. Every day I'd be asking, will it be me next? Verse 7. I am for peace. But when I speak, they are for war. I mean, do you know anything of that? You're not trying to stir it. Now, I am for peace. Literally, I am peace. Peace is my middle name, if you like. But with some people, whatever you say, they fire back as if World War III has just broken out. Dyson Hayden was a justice in the Australian High Court. And he spoke of those with power and influence on issues as elites. And he said this once. He said, modern elites do not desire tolerance. They demand unconditional surrender. They don't just want to win the argument. They don't want the alternative even to be put. A friend of mine's been the vicar of a significant parish for 20 years or more now, and he was telling me of his older brother at school and of how one day another boy saw his brother's daily bread Bible reading notes in his bag. And he picked them up and he paraded them in front of the class, and then he just ripped them up in front of everyone. You know, he was just appealing to the pack mentality of school kids. The vicar told the story with some glee because I was the boy who ripped them up. Now, I wasn't converted then, you'll be glad to hear. You see, in my school days, it was the peer group who waged the war. Today, I hear again and again and again of teachers leading the attack on a pupil's Christian views. Woe is me. Too long. Those pupils know the taste of those words all too well. Feel the distress. Grasp the hope. Taste the despair. The psalmist wants us to do all these things. Then you'll grow the appetite to meet the one who hears our cries. See, hundreds of years after this song was written, came the one who would taste it to the full. Emmanuel, God with us. Lying lips, deceitful tongues, they started when he was still in the womb. The whisperings about being illegitimate. They continued in his ministry when he was challenged and questioned and accused of doing the devil's work for him. They caused his execution with the rigged trial against him. They mocked him all the way to his death. Jesus the Lord walked this psalm for himself. It's why the writer to the Hebrews claims that we don't have a high priest, Jesus, who's unable to feel sympathy for our weakness, but we have one who's been tempted in every way just as we are. Yet he did not sin. See, doesn't it make a difference to have someone who understands? Woe is me, the psalmist says, and Jesus knows that sigh. Oh, he wasn't a tutter either. He didn't moralize and wag his finger. He wept for Jerusalem. For the judgment she'd face, he cried out for her. How often have I hoped to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. I am peace. I mean, Jesus could say that more than anyone in history, yet he found they are for war. Crucify, crucify was their cry. A robber, a murderer, a Barabbas got their vote. Look, the distress, the despair may be very real for you. Very real for me. But surely, if I were going to cry out to anyone, it would be to this Lord. The Lord who understands. That's why the writer goes on, let's then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. See, I don't know what sort of journey you see yourself on. You may feel yourself here just as an individual. For one reason or another, you're far from God and wanting to reconnect, to come back to Him. Well, here's the one to come to. And there is nothing you will need more than mercy and grace. Or it may all be more of a together thing. You know, we're here together. Under God, building a community of God's people, the city of God, if you like, in the middle of those who don't want to know, who resent our intrusion, who see us as an interference, who, if they can't remove us, want to neutralize us. How do we keep going? Only with liberal servings of mercy and grace to help in time of need. Here's where the journey starts. In the dark, with the distress, at the end of our tether. And here's the surprise. A God who, despite all of that, understands, has walked the walk Himself. What more can I expect from Him? Well, that's for the next tune to the journey. Right now, let's cry to the one who understands and answers. Let's be still for a moment, then let me lead us in a prayer. I call on the Lord in my distress, and He answers me. Almighty God, thank You for a God who understands. Thank You for a God who listens. Thank You for a God to whom we can cry, save me, and know You will answer. Pour out Your mercy on us, and give us grace to help in time of need, we pray. In the name of the Jesus who understands us. Amen.